and welcome to Talking Who to You, a podcast dedicated to the big finish audio adventures of Doctor Who. My name is JG Macquarie, and as always, I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Koser. Say hi, Kevin.
Hi.
This week, we're continuing with the Divergent Universe arc, and that means we are going to be covering the Creed of the Chromon. Now, last week, we had Scherzo, and for all that it was maybe a little bit of a flawed story in places, it was a good, strong contender to get this arc off to a start. This week, as I say, we have the Creed of the Chromon. Kevin, straight into it. How did you find this one?
This is simultaneously just, like, repulsive but also boring, which you don't think would happen. And yet, here we are. It's really just uninteresting. There's so many ideas being thrown at the wall. So it's really a miracle how this is so uninteresting. But I think it's because, like, there's a lot of ideas, but there's no weight or interest to them, and so it just sort of falls flat. And half the scenes feel like they're killing time, which is just so boring.
Only half the scenes? Okay, wow, then I guess you like this better than I did.
Yeah, I was being very generous, I feel like, now.
Yeah, exactly. But before we get stuck in too many details, do you want to give people a little summary of what happens in this one, if you were awake long enough to find out?
Sure. In the Creed of the Chromon, the Doctor and Charlie first encounter the Kroka as he guides them through the interzone into the zone of Euterimus. None of that makes sense to me either, and this is my second time going through these episodes. and Zone Euterimus, they are captured by these termite-like rulers called the Chromon, who enslave the Euterimogens and the Urug, do their bidding with brainwashing elixirs. They meet future companion K'Riz and basically run around a facility a bunch, free Charlie of some horrific body horror experimentation, and overthrow the evil aliens and escape. And that takes nearly 2.5 hours. It's a long story.
Yeah, if that sounds like every basic Doctor Who story you've ever heard in your life, well, there's a pretty good reason for that. I guess we should maybe, I mean, I don't want to linger on the sort of Divergent Universe arc too much, but that is kind of how this play kicks off. So we get to spend a little bit of time in the Interzone with the Kroka. And, you know, some of that isn't completely awful. And, yeah, you know, that's, I think episode one is probably the best episode of the four that we're given here. And there's some little intriguing hints that are dropped here and there, and we get a little sort of suggestion about what might be going on or whatever. And it's sort of, I suppose there's something slightly refreshing about the Doctor and Charlie just being dropped into a situation without kind of any of the usual sort of faffing about. So there's no, of course, there's no sort of TARDIS scene to get things off, and there's no shortcuts that need to be taken. It's just like sort of bang into the middle of that sort of situation, and then kind of on you go. I'm kind of with you in terms of, I think this story doesn't go out of its way to try and explain kind of the interzone of the Kroka very much. I think it's kind of okay at this point. I think by the fact that we get a wrap-up at the sort of far end of the play as well, it's starting to creak a little bit. But I don't mind it at the start of the play. And, you know, it's at least, it's trying to generate a little bit of atmosphere. So when they actually land on the planet, or arrive rather than land, I suppose we should say, you know, we get a bit of a sense that the Doctor and Charlie are kind of exploring this environment in a slightly, it's a slightly old-fashioned feel to it, but that's okay. That little bit works. So, hurrah! I find something that I could actually focus on the positive on.
Yeah, I would say that first segment is actually pretty strong too. I mentioned I don't understand it, but that's more of a bigger Divergent arc issue where I really don't understand how the zones and everything works. And this, no story really goes that way to explain it. But I do like the Kroka as a character. And he's not so much in this play, but you get to see a little bit of it. But he's kind of fun. More to the point, though, that first scene's just strong because you get a lot of good acting from McGann and Fisher, which they won't really try to clock in again for much of the rest of the story. Stephen Paring as a Kroka is a nice sort of malevolent presence that's bring some energy to those scenes. And then you have some fun cool things with, like, the bug swarming and the R101 flashback. It's the sort of idea of them being sort of psychically pinned down and interrogated. It's more action that happens in the rest of the story, pretty much. So it's, yeah, you're right. That first segment is, like, not unbelievably strong, but in comparison, it's, seems like a good start. And as a way of sort of setting up how the Divergent universe will generally go, where you start a story with them interacting with the Kroka, and sort of interacting with the Kroka, and you're sort of getting more and more drips and details about how the universe functions through that, it's nice. But then you get into the actual heart of the story, and it just all falls apart.
Yeah, fairly spectacularly. I mean, with the Kroka, nothing, it doesn't connect to anything here, but then it's obviously not meant to. It's a framing device, that's all it is in this story, and that's perfectly fine. I think those initial moments of exploration are quite nice in the planet. It's this kind of dry, dusty environment. We get some nice little guitar motifs as well, which are and the incidental music, which are it makes sort of quite a nice change from the usual sort of synth and strings approach that we get. And it's a little bit sort of it strikes a slightly different atmosphere, especially in the McGann audios, which have been very kind of claustrophobic over the last sort of few stories that we've listened to. So it's nice. It feels a little bit more expansive. Actually, some of the music reminded me a little bit of Survival as well. And anything that reminds me of Survival is only a good thing. But it all bleaches away. And it's such a shame because, ultimately, no real spoilers here, but the Creed of the Chroma just isn't very good. I kind of wish it were, but we're only into the second story into the sort of Divergent Universe arc, and already we're kind of hitting a brick wall. I mean, the thing about this story is it's very, very traditional in the way that it's kind of structured. But if you're going to present a traditional story, if you're going to do something which is kind of, I mean, I don't want to do the whole rad v trad thing because that's kind of a bit obvious, but this is a very, very traditional story, and kind of like the Doctor turns up somewhere. We've got maybe like three or four locations, about three or four different characters, and that's your lot. Go away and build a story. But it doesn't. If you're going to present something that way, that structure, you need to try and do something with it. You like something that's going to shake it up, or just you can't just present it as if it's still 1986 and expect that to sort of function in sort of 2004. And I think that's really one of the biggest flaws of Creed of the Chroma. And it just doesn't have anything new to kind of add to Doctor Who. And, this is written by Philip Martin, obviously, writer of Mind Warp and Vengeance on Varos, both of which I think are pretty strong stories. But it's not something that comes across here as strong at all. And it's because I think he's still writing as if it's 20 years ago. Well, it's not. And you can't really get away with that anymore.
Yeah, it's very true. Like, I would say Varos and Mind Warp, they're definitely look better in comparison to the stories around them, but they're solid. I think the problem with Creed of the Crawman is that, like, they didn't even have the little moments of interest that make those two stories, especially Varos, like, stand out. At least Varos had this sort of clumsy but well-meaning sort of satire of the sort of reality entertainment and everything like that. That brought more life to the story, and also more interesting characters and Syl. Now, interesting at least. I don't know how you would stand on him or as much as you like him, but interesting. Yeah, Crommon has no interesting characters. Everything just feels like incident without much consequence. It's just a lot of running around in this very formless setting that we don't really get much detail on. And it really does just. Yeah, it just doesn't land any part of it. It just doesn't connect with me at any sort of level.
No, well, I think that's perfectly fair enough. And I think what the biggest kind of flaw here is that, I mean, almost everybody who's going to listen to this is going to have heard it before. And like, even if you're not a Doctor Who fan, you're going to find all of these elements kind of familiar. I mean, like the Chronom with their kind of rules and regulations and literal mindedness. Well, that could just as easily be the Vogons from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You have all this the hives and the way that these are supposed to be sort of insect-like. Well, that you could easily sort of project that onto the Borg. The dependence on water is about the least interesting characteristic you could give any species, because like almost all species are at some point dependent on water, but that they don't really do much with that except as a handy way of making sure that there's a way to defeat them by the end. The whole kill me scene is lifted directly from Aliens. Even if it's not wasn't directly lifted from Aliens, we've already seen it in Doctor Who and Revelation of the Daleks, and so on and so on. All these elements are just kind of presented as if they're sort of de facto interesting, and they're not. They're sort of repetitious and rather derivative. As you said, at least Vengeance on Varos had that kind of that satirical element, but there's no like this like the fact that the Chronom are very kind of bureaucratic and whatever, apart from being very sub kind of Douglas Adams. It just there's no attempt at satire, and the thing is we've seen this, or I mean you and I have listened to something like this relatively recently when we covered Davros. We can see how good a satire Doctor Who can make of kind of, you know, capitalism and bureaucracy and all these kind of elements, but it's a much, much smarter script than we're presented with here.
Yeah, that's really interesting to bring up Douglas Adams. I was thinking the same thing too, the reveal that the Kraman built the whole society over, like, essentially an employee manual taken from this corporation is, I mean, that's a great concept, but so little is done with it. Like, all it means is that you have these termites calling each other technical director and chairman and such, but there's none of the attitude there. They don't, like, act like corporate stooges. And that could be funny if there was, like, this sort of mapping of corporate culture onto a sort of alien base. Instead, they just behave like an alien base, and we're told, oh, they follow these rules very strictly. But we don't even really get scenes of them following rules very strictly. They just behave as they behave. They take a queen, they need her to hatch some eggs, they move around like any alien guard would do, guarding important places. There's nothing that really conveys that brilliant idea of aliens copying corporate culture, because they don't really. It's just sort of told to us and never shown. It's a very strange idea and a way to fumble such a brilliant concept by basically not engaging with it at all.
Well, there's one engagement with it. That first time that the Doctor is able to kind of escape and he kind of gets access to their computer. And so he uses it to convince the computer and the Chronom that he's been pacified along with Charlie and that Karis has been successfully disposed of. So he can just be ignored from now on. They do it that once and they use it to sort of escape from that situation. But then they never do it again. And like later on, they just go, oh, well, yeah, we found out that you lied, so we've changed things. It doesn't stick to its own core concept. It just uses it once as an excuse to get the Doctor and the companions out of the situation and then just doesn't bother going back to it. Yeah, you're right. It's a really weird way to kind of fumble this sort of initial sort of, yeah, quite an interesting idea. It just sort of evaporates, and the Chronom never really emerge as kind of an interesting or a distinct species in any other way. So the fact that they had this one concept, which is then just kind of frittered away, and then nothing else kind of really emerges to replace it, just means that they end up being incredibly kind of indistinct, and as a result it's very difficult to care whether they're defeated or whether they're not defeated. It's not even all that clear beyond kind of basic survival what they want to achieve. Like, there's some stuff about space flight, but it's not really terribly convincing either. And it's just all this kind of stuff, and it doesn't add up to anything.
I mean, speaking of stuff, I mean, there's just so many scenes where characters like talk to each other saying, all right, I'm going to do this. And the next scene they do something, or the next scene they just say, I'm going to do this again. Standouts include the Arug coming to Karis in the water wheel just to say, I'll come back and get you. And the next scene we see of them is him coming back and getting him. It's just such a decompression of time that feels wasteful. You have other scenes where, like, you have the Doctor and Karis walking up to level 5 to find Charlie. And in the next scene, they're still walking level 5 and find Charlie, and they're having the same conversation pretty much. Oh, are you going to kill her? Oh, I don't think I can. They just hit the same beats over and over again. And it gets stuck in these patterns and moves so slowly because of it. I mean, there's really no reason to. This could have been immensely trimmed down. And it's so confusing why the writer Philip Martin doesn't feel the need to sort of get this fat out of the way.
Well, it's another good example of what a difference a decent script editor could make. Because I think if some of that fat was trimmed away, you could get this down to, like, I think I mentioned this before, I'm not somebody who thinks that Doctor Who by default should be 4 episodes of 25 minutes length. I don't mind how long an episode is, as long as there's enough in there to justify it. And I mean, of course, you know what I'm going to say now, but there just isn't enough to justify it here. This doesn't need to be 2.25 hours long. This could easily be a sort of relatively lean traditional four-parter. And it's not like traditional four-parter is an unfair way to go. Everything about this story is traditional. You know, all the setups, all the plots, all the characters, all the beats, everything that we've been talking about so far, it's all completely traditional. So, like, a 25-minute episode, maybe a 30-minute episode for the part one and part four to sort of include the stuff with the interzone. And, you know, you could do something quite nice. I mean, oh, there's so few characters here, but they all stand around just sort of repeatedly kind of restating everything that they already know. And the one exception to that is kind of the Urog, which is a really nice character that is completely wasted. It's introduced in part one, where it's sort of quite a pleasingly different sort of presence. It's another one of the things that makes that first episode, I think, that wee bit stronger. You know, it's got that, it's just a different kind of presence. And, but you, I mean, like, the second it's introduced, you know that the Urog is going to be the thing that gets them out of trouble come part four. It's not even like a Chekhov's gun thing. It's too clumsy even for that. It's just so obvious. And yeah, right enough, that's exactly what happens in part four. And it's a shame. It's a nice little performance. And the character, again, is quite interesting. But it's just another one of the concepts which is rather wasted here.
I really like Brian Cobbey's very sort of gentle performance. I think you could almost call it ASMR in terms of just how like just soothing it is. Like, it's a very interesting character where he's like this very nice sort of friendly creature, but still has like claws to him in both a metaphorical and literal sense, and no compunctions about killing people around him. We're definitely going to talk about how many people die in this story, because it is very Doctor Who like. I guess it maybe depends on the era. But yeah, it's the Urog. It's a very interesting character, and I like him a lot. He's a good presence, like you said. Like, he's kind and gentle, but a very rough-voiced and very rough character as well. So, yeah, and it's just a shame that he's very one-dimensional. Like, he just shows up at the beginning to help them out, and then shows up at the end to help them out.
Well, I think the problem with the Urog is that all of the sort of quality of that character is coming from Brian Cobbey's performance. I don't think much of it is really on the page. And because of that, it means that the Urog is really more plot than character. I think the performance is kind of good enough to make up a lot of that distance, but it's not good enough to make up all of that distance, which is no, I don't mean that as an insult to Brian Cobbey at all. I think he really does bring that character to life in a way that sort of maybe a lot of other actors wouldn't have been able to do. But yeah, ultimately, it's just a plot device. It's not a character which really, you know, has any kind of interiority or any kind of sort of life beyond necessity of helping the Doctor to escape come part four. And that's such a shame, because it is nice. And the play would really benefit from investing a little bit more time in him.
Yeah, and that just, I don't know, it just makes it all the more frustrating that these things are sort of, like, not capitalized on. There's so many ideas, not just the two we've mentioned about the manual and the Urog, but then also, like, this idea about needing the sort of royalty/breeders in order to keep the race alive, and you have the water dependency, and then we also can get into the Divergent arc stuff, where how no one knows, I have a concept of time, though this is very light. It just means people don't know what time is, which seems very silly and not really explored at all. At every opportunity the play has to explore something interesting, it just doesn't take it, and instead just wants to tell this very conventional story about the Doctor and Caterers running around this place trying to rescue Charlie.
The whole thing about they don't understand the concept of time is such, I mean, I really want to swear here, but I won't, because we definitely don't swear in this podcast, but it's such garbage. Oh, these people, they have absolutely no concept of time. They do seem to have a past tense and a future tense, though, but still, they've got absolutely no concept of time. It's just rubbish. It doesn't stand up to even the slightest bit of scrutiny, and it's not even sort of internally consistent. I think one of the there's something slightly sweet about the way that, you know, when the Cronum are sort of interrogating the Doctor, they're desperate to try and find, you know, the secret of space travel. When normally, under those circumstances, they're always, you know, the Doctor's always trying to, you know, it's always time travel that they're trying to get out of the Doctor. That's always the big secret that needs to be cracked. So it makes the Cronum seem slightly quaint in a way, I suppose. And that there's something slightly not appealing, that's too strong a word, but there's something quite nice about that. But that's literally the only time this has kind of any impact in the plot at all. And it's just so obvious that nobody has come close to thinking through kind of the implications of how that would work. I mean, Rob Shearman couldn't really pull it off last week. And, you know, like, Rob Shearman is arguably the best writer Big Finish I've ever had. And Philip Martin is not arguably the best writer Big Finish I've ever had. So, you know, like, if Rob Shearman couldn't pull it off, and he does a good job, but if he couldn't pull it off, I'm sorry, but Philip Martin is definitely not going to be able to.
No spoilers, but I think next episode we're going to see maybe the only time where this Divergent Universe lack of time actually feels coherent. Every other time, it just, yeah, it is just sort of nonsense where people say, well, we don't know what time is. Okay, I'll go rescue you from this water wheel the next day. Like, yeah, how do you know exactly what the next day is? It's just very weird. And you'll probably hear us complain a lot about this in future episodes, and I'm sorry about that, listeners, but that's just what we have to keep struggling with, is how this Divergent arc as a whole doesn't come to these sort of fruition. But I guess to focus back on Kraman, it's just another example of how Kraman sort of lets down any ambition it has by just not being very ambitious about its own ambition. It just has these concepts and then just thinks that's enough and then filler texts the rest, which is so frustrating.
Yeah, there's no real way that we're going to avoid repeating ourselves over this aspect of the Divergent Universe. But, you know, listeners, we suffer, so you don't have to. But, you know, I mean, I think even with, I mean, it's just, it's so frustrating. I need to move on from talking about the time thing. Otherwise, I'm just going to end up in a time loop of my own where I just complain about it. Right, something different. Let's talk about Karras, because this is meant to be his big introductory story. I'm sorry, that wasn't a very graceful transition, but I need to step away from it. How did you find Karras in this one?
This is going to be such a short episode. how do you say anything about Karras? I think the Kroka at the end sort of sums up Karras' character's best. Like, you know, before I met you, the Doctor, he was a monk. And he didn't really explain what that even means for you Termazin monk to be. We just have to take it as he wouldn't have killed his wife, but he did kill his wife. And then he wants to kill Charlie. I guess he really changed then, didn't he? Changed from what? From who? Who is he? Like, his only emotions in the story are, I want to find my wife. Oh, I'm horrified for my wife and I have to kill her. Oh, I have to kill Charlie to prevent the same fate for some reason. And then, I mean, that's it. And then just sort of basic life instincts of, I don't want to die, I'm running away. We don't get much of a personality from him. Like, I feel like if he was a guest character, we'd be criticizing, oh, this guy was kind of thin, and I don't know why they're in the story. The fact that as a companion like that is a very bad sign of things to come.
Yeah, well, I don't have an awful lot to add to that, really. He's pretty inadequate as a companion, and at least as far as this is concerned, as far as his debut is, he's kind of very petulant, and he's annoying, and like the range of emotions that Karras is given to display here seem to be a little bit beyond the reach of Conrad Westmas. It's not that this is the most rounded character in the world. It's definitely not that here. But, you know, Conrad Westmas does seem to struggle to get a lot of the kind of like the big kind of melodrama moments to land. He's kind of better, I think, that maybe at playing a little bit quiet and having to deal with the sort of little emotional beats. Yeah, I think he's maybe a little bit more effective when he does that. But like the big deal of when Lyra, his apparent love, although not that we're given any connection to her or spend any time with her, but okay, sure, we're told that must be the case. So yeah, I guess that must be the case. But you know, he gives it these big soaring kind of moments of oh my God, I've had to kill her. And it just, none of it really lands. And you know, again, his most effective moments are probably in the first episode. Keep coming back to that. But, you know, but he's unconscious for some of it, so that helps. And, you know, for the rest of it, it's a bit, you know, it's just sort of fairly standard, who are you, why are you here fare. And he's okay at that, but that's, so what? That doesn't tell us anything, and it doesn't really make him a particularly engaging character.
I definitely think what he needs, yeah, is just some sort of basic motivation, like time spent with him to show what he's like that makes him different from just generic person. Because in the script, does him no favors, like you said, because a lot of it is just all of our main characters just operating on these, well, either operating on these very basic fight or flight instincts and just trying to move from one place to the next and get out of the situation, or acting brainwashed, which you can't judge the character at all when they're acting brainwashed. So it's very strange. Like, you can't really get a sense of him at all. Like, he's doing nothing interesting or quirky or different. He just, you know, acts how you'd expect someone to react in every situation. And then who is that person? You don't know. You don't have a sense from at all. So when it makes that Kroger speech at the end about how the doctor changed him and by being around him, I mean, it's like, where does they glean from that? It's the epitome of telling and not showing, because we weren't shown anything and we're just being told something that is now incoherent.
Well, yeah, exactly. It if we're not given enough time to spend with the character, how are we supposed to understand how the character has changed? And it's, yeah, you're 100% correct. And I think, I mean, a lot of the annoyances that I had with the character here is like when he's being sort of faced with like the food that he's meant to partially digest, or the maggots, and mm-hmm. he just goes, ooh, kind of performance. It's just incredibly juvenile and annoying, and not in an interesting way. I mean, it's not like Adric levels of badness or anything, but, you know, it kind of suggests that, you know, given time, we might end up in that direction. And it's just, I don't know, it's not like one of the other things is like, if you were going to go for that kind of approach to the character, then give us a bit of background detail. Like maybe he is a petulant teenager and this is the only way he knows how to react. We don't know, because we're not given that much biographical information about him. We're not given really any biographical information about him at all. And he doesn't explain himself in any way. So there's no sense that we can get a grip on how this character is or who this character is. And I think, you know, it's, I mean, you know, like, what's weird about it is, like, they bother to give him the quirk of the fact that an audio companion is capable of changing skin tone. Like, that's quite a funny gag, okay? I'll give the script that. That's quite amusing. But that's it. That's about as far as we go. And it's just so, yeah, I mean, he can stand there and ask, what's this, Doctor? But what's that adding to the show? We have Charlie for that. We don't need another character who can stand there and say, what's this, Doctor? It's so inadequate, and there just doesn't seem to be, there's no, other than, as you said, that one thing about, oh well, he was a monk and whatever, right at the very, very back end of the episode, we're not given, like, it's not even intriguing, it's just there.
To go back to your time about the maggot scene, I think that's sort of the problem, is like a scene like that where it gets a strong reaction out of him is where you learn something about a character. And what we learn about him is, like a sane person, he does not want to deal with maggots. And then he just asks, can I go somewhere else? And then they let him. And he gives the lie to, and like,
that's so,
like, so
feeble.
Yeah, I guess. So I guess it was the take from him. He's like very, yeah, he's just grossed out by things. Like someone, it could be anyone, like I said. There's nothing about him that's unique or interesting besides, well, and the fact that he is this alien from the Divergent Zone, you talked about the skin changing, and that is unique, but that's just something, that's also something that people have to tell us directly when it happens. And I don't know, I guess count the number of stories where they actually tell us, oh, Caris, your skin tone changed. Because, you know, it's not going to be much, it's not going to be a super relevant detail for his character. It's just a thing, but it's not, it doesn't inform him in any way. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of probably like frustration or care is over this podcast, or maybe we'll just forget about him every episode, but who can say?
Well, we can only try. But you know, if Caris is not given a strong introduction, and here we go, this is a slightly stronger transition than last time, Charlie is woeful here. She's mm-hmm. really, really badly handled. She's just reduced to being an absolute sort of peril monkey. She's just abused by the plot, and she gets stuck in a position where she needs to be rescued, and then she is, and that's it. That's all that happens to Charlie throughout this whole thing. You know, it doesn't give India Fisher anything to work with, but then again, she sounds incredibly bored by the material, so it's not like she's kind of upping her performance to fill in the gaps. I don't blame her, to be clear, for being bored by the material. It's not exactly inspiring stuff, but you know, Scherzo gave us strong material, and I think we could both sort of appreciate during Scherzo that she was, you could hear how much more effort India Fisher was sort of putting into the performance, and there was a real kind of connectivity with the way that she was playing off Paul McGann and all these kind of things. You know, it was interesting, and it was that sort of strong material was given her something that she could really sort of get her teeth into. But there's that doesn't exist here. And as I say, Charlie is just reduced to being this kind of peril monkey. And there's also, I think, there's something deeply uncomfortable about the fact that the only two female characters in the entire play are basically abused and are killed by the male characters. And I don't want to call it misogynistic, but it is, so I'm going to. It's very misogynistic, I think. The female character, they're treated appallingly, really, really badly. And there's really no kind of justification for it at all. It seems to be written sort of very reflexively by Philip Martin. And when we remember what happened to Perry in Vengeance on Varys with her sort of transformation into a bird, and again what happened to Perry in Mind Warp, where she was sort of brainwashed and taken over and all the rest of it, and then eventually killed. There's a pattern emerging here, I think, in the way that Philip Martin kind of writes female characters. I can't think of any examples in those two stories where there are kind of like strong female characters or female characters who are anything other than kind of victimized. Maybe I'm missing one. Maybe you can think of one, but I can't think of one off the top of my head anyway. So he seems to see these female characters as real kind of plot fodder. And they're there to be tied up or beaten or abused or transformed or whatever it is. And they only really exist to kind of give the male character something to leer over or something or somebody to be kind of rescued. It's very undermining to the play, and I don't think it speaks very highly to the way that Philip Martin kind of views women. I think as far as this play is concerned, it's a miracle that nobody's tied to railway tracks.
Yeah, it doesn't inspire much confidence in that at all. I was going to definitely bring up that too, where how Charlie's transformation here, and I'm going to have to say, that's like relatively one of the more interesting things that happens in this story, that sort of horrible Cronenbergian transformation. I mean, at least it's something happening, and it's gross in unadmirable ways, but I could argue gross in admirable ways in that it like sort of, at least, you know, it gets you a reaction out of you, I'd say, in that very sort of David Cronenberg kind of way, if I'm making sense.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But also, it's like a ripoff of Vengeance of Varos, which he wrote. And also, yeah, it puts the one female character of any consequence into this very uncomfortable position, and it's just hard to sit through it. And it's, again, so long. There are so many scenes where it's like, Charlie, you're transforming now. And she's like, oh, yes, I'm transforming. You're transforming even more now. On and on and on. Maybe 10 scenes of just the only development in that scene being that, just checking in with her, and she just sounds grosser and more awful and more disgusting, and then checking out with nothing actually progressing. And it's just difficult to listen to. And it's just kind of boring. Like, it could have been fascinating. I think maybe the one scene that really does succeed is when she notices that her legs have become sticks. I got a little bit of a jump out of me. But besides that, it's just repetition over and over again, dulling what could have been very impactful. And on top of what you said, all the uncomfortable implications by the fact that she's like the only female character of consequence going through all of this while the men have to rescue her. Like, there's just a cocktail of stuff sort of of the play getting into its own way, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the only other female character that we have at all is Lyda, which is Karis's partner. I can't remember if he refers to her as his wife, but anyway, his wife. Okay. And she's. I mean, that's just a fridging trope. We don't know anything about her. We don't spend any time with her at all. She only exists to die, so that Karis has, you know, some kind of motivation or something to angst over to motivate him. You know, it's the most sort of straightforward fridging that you could possibly have, and it's just really clumsy, bad writing from somebody who is meant to be kind of very social and very political. You know, that was always meant to be Philip Martin's kind of strengths as a writer, and whatever I mean, it clearly isn't something that either that he is aware of or cares about, but it's very, very obvious if you're even slightly aware of these things, just how kind of crass a lot of this sort of stuff is. And I didn't, I mean, I would have loved to have gone into this story and sort of been able to find a redemptive angle on it, but it's really tough. There's just really not a lot to recommend. Normally we'll talk about a story and then find some weeds, and this time we're kind of doing it the other way around. We've basically just slacked the story off, and I'm now desperately trying to think of something positive that I can say about it. They go, oh well, that was good, but I've got to be honest, I am struggling a wee bit.
Well, that's the thing, everything positive you can say about the story undermines it every chance it can get to make it more boring and less interesting. Like, I think I've been sort of hitting on things that I find, oh, this was sort of interesting, or oh, this could have been a good idea, but then, like, you have to bring up how the story undercuts it at every possible moment, because it just can't stop itself from being taking the most boring tack, the most uninteresting tack, and the most repulsive tack at every sort of opportunity, which is just so, it's just so frustrating to listen to, and you just don't know. It really does feel like a first draft or an outline more than an actual story. It just feels like Mad Libs almost, punching in the words, just random words to the most generic possible story you can think of. There's just nothing here beyond the very basic tenets that could possibly be somewhat special, but executed in the most boring way possible.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I like, even like, what is it? When Karras is going to be executed, it's like the classic villain thing of, right, you've got him, kill him. No, instead, I'm going to tie him to this water wheel where he will definitely be rescued. And it's just like, you know, I mean, this looked kind of ham-fisted when it was happening in James Bond in 1965. Never mind when it's happening in, like, 2004. It's just the most kind of, oh yeah, because he, like, needs to be an example to people or something. And anyway, we'll just make sure that you can escape here for reasons, I guess. Yeah, I don't, it's hard to imagine that kind of cliche, sort of somebody of, you know, like Philip Martin's a well-written, a well-regarded, well-published writer. It's not like he's kind of like some hack from the middle of nowhere. He's, you know, how can he not have been aware of how lazy and cliche this is?
I mean, yeah, co-signing all of that is just awful stuff. If I can find one silver lining, though, there is one thing I do like, and that is The Doctor's Business in episode 3, where he pretends to be brainwashed. And it's a very neat little long con where his goal is basically to give them what they need about space travel in order to sort of subdue their torture of him, since he'll be tortured if he doesn't comply. So he will overcomply to the point of confusing them, and then when the experiment justifiably blows up in their face, he can make a clean getaway. It's clever. Again, it takes every possible chance to make it boring, because we're just cutting to the Doctor techno-babbling and Crawman going, yes, sure. Of course I understand. And like, we know where it's headed, pretty much. It's going to head with the Doctor giving them what they want, but not really giving them what they want, and then using that as a way to escape. So, yeah, it's not great, but it is, again, it's another good idea that I liked that is then not given the maximum effectiveness it could have.
Well, it's one of the rare examples of an idea which is overextended rather than underextended, because, as you said, there is a lot of the Doctor just kind of making up all this kind of baffle-gab stuff to try and confuse his opponents. And that's fine. Okay, we've seen the Doctor do that before, but it does go on maybe a bit longer than it necessarily needs to. But yeah, you're right. The idea behind that is a solid one, and the Doctor's using his intelligence to try and defeat the bad guys. It's not just about somebody riding to the rescues or pew 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 laser guns. Oh, that's another thing. Those guns have the most like generic pew 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 laser gun noises imaginable. I know that's such a small trivial thing to pick on. It is, of course it is. But it just really annoyed me every time I listened to it. Every time somebody fired the gun, it was this terrible tacky 1950s ray gun noise. It was just awful. Anyway, sorry, that wasn't what I was talking about. What was I saying? Oh yeah, that was it. Yeah, no, you're right. That is one that scene where the Doctor uses his intelligence to get away. That's a definite silver lining.
Yeah, but speaking of climaxes involving pew pew guns, I mean that's the climax of episode 3, which is great. Episode 4 is just Kairos and Urugs like gunning and clawing people down, which, I mean, I can't say has never happened in Doctor Who before, like. As far back as the second Doctor era with that Ice Warriors or Seeds of Either Doom or Death, since it's
Seeds
two
of Death.
Of them. Yeah. He's gunning the Ice Warriors at the end of that. So it's not four in the Doctor Who, but it's always disappointing when you get an ending like that because you know the show is better than that. And the best Doctor Who endings do rely on that intelligence and that wit. And here, the solution to fighting the Kramon is gun downing on the aliens, pew pew pew, they kill the queens and the rest collapse, which is another very cliche sci-fi thing. And then they rescue Charlie and she's fine and everything's good, only it takes like 15 minutes after they rescue Charlie for them to get to the end of the episode. It's such a long story with so little incident, and again, it's just that's just such a generic and boring ending, possibly the most boring ending you can have for a Doctor Who story.
Well, the play even kind of flags up the fact that it doesn't really know how to deal with its own ending, because we understand that this is in Biodome 1 or Biodome A, I forget what it is. And, you know, they managed to defeat the Kromen in this one. And then the Doctor says, ah, but they'll be coming from the other ones. And then they don't. And it's like, oh, right. So, I guess that's okay then. So, on to the next zone. It's like it can't even be bothered to find a convincing excuse. I know it does have an excuse, but it's just so wildly unconvincing that it can't even be bothered to kind of justify. I mean, there isn't a good answer to that point, but then that's sort of the issue. You know, Philip Martin has painted himself into this corner whereby, okay, we've defeated one dome, but there's like half a dozen. Well, I guess they're defeated as well. So off we go. Yeah, no.
Yeah, and it's just, oh yeah, I can't even remember the explanation they give for why they don't come. There's just no reason. It's just very flat and pat. And that's just the whole story. Like, I know we haven't been talking very long, but we might have to wrap it now because I can't think of anything else to say. This story is one of the most interesting Doctor Who stories ever just because it never puts the effort in.
No, there's absolutely no effort here as well. And the thing is that if we're talking about the range of kind of Eighth Doctor stories that we've been covering, we talked about Scherzo last week, and that's fine. We were both generally very positive about it. But it was ambitious. Even if you're the sort of person who doesn't particularly like it, and I know there's plenty of people out there that aren't really a big fan of Scherzo, even if you don't like it, I think it's impossible to deny that it has kind of ambition and range, and it's trying to really kind of push the formula. Yeah, of course, your mileage may vary as to whether it succeeds or not, but it's got a real core to it that's trying to do something different. And for all the hard time that we've given Zagreus, and Nevermind as well, they are both, there is ambition in them. I particularly think that, you know, some of that ambition could have been whittled back and produced much stronger material, particularly in the case of Zagreus. But, you know, still, it is trying something, even if it failed spectacularly. I think the biggest failing of Creed of the Kromon is that it's not really trying anything. There's nothing here. It's sort of fine if you want to write a traditional story. You know, The Spectre of Lanyon Moor is a very traditional story, but at least it's engaging and interesting and there's some good performances in there. You know, this is just a flat traditional story and it has got absolutely no sort of range or ambition or interest in doing anything other than sort of filling up 2 hours of airtime, and that's just not good enough.
Especially when it has to both introduce a companion and really properly introduce us to the Divergent universe outside of that one closed experiment the Doctor and Charlie were in. Like, Scherzo, even within the bounds of the Divergent universe, is a weird one-off story. It's not really, like, what the universe is like. And they even call it as a very closed-off place. So this is what the Divergent universe as a whole looks like. And it looks like any other alien planet. And Kara is supposed to be a dynamic companion who are supposed to be these more interesting characters who bring these like fascinating personalities to match wits with the Doctor and carry stories of their own with other maybe flatter guest cast characters. And he's just a nothing of a character. So it just fails on so many levels that it needs to succeed at for the good of the range as a whole. And that just makes it such, like, even more damning than it already is.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, actually, about the way that it just could have been. This could be a story that featured any Doctor and featured any companion. There's absolutely nothing about this story that demands that it's the Eighth Doctor that's in it or that it's part of the Divergent Universe arc. This is just such a generic story. And this could be Tom Baker. This could be, you know, Matt Smith. It doesn't matter. This could be anyone at all in this story. And that's just such a... That's such a failure when this is going to be your big shot, really getting into the nitty-gritty of this allegedly new situation that the Doctor and Charlie are going to find themselves in. It's such a failure of ambition.
Well, we've managed to lurch past the 45-minute mark. Hopefully we don't go under that with editing. I say let's call it quits there because there is nothing left to get from this story. And yeah, we have no emails today, so please email us at talkingwhotoyou@gmail.com. Those emails really help us pad out the length for these very shorter episodes when we're trying to draw water out of stone here. And then you can also find us on Twitter at Talking Who to You. You can find me on Twitter at Kev Kozer. That is KevKoeser. And you can find more of JG's writing at www.jgmcquarrie.scott. That is JGMCQUARRIE.Scott.
An excellent job of fleshing out this episode by spelling everything that we possibly can. Well, thanks, Kevin. Next week, we will be remaining in the Divergent Universe, Try to Suppress Your Joy, and we will reach the third story in this arc. That would be The Natural History of Fear. We hope you're going to join us for it, especially after suffering through the Creed of the Chromon. But until then, keep talking.